From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
The government is the one institution with the patience and resources to buy these assets at their current low prices and hold them until markets return to normal.
The economic crisis. It's been called the biggest financial disaster since the Great Depression. But what role do Latinos play in all of this?
The people who got stuck holding the bag in the first place are now at the top of the list in terms of losing their homes and getting their credits destroyed.
Also, low wages and poor conditions continue for workers in maquiladoras all along the U.S.-Mexico border. It's been 15 years of NAFTA, so what does it look like on the border?
Maquila is like un mal necesario, no? Like a necessary evil.
This and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Joining us to discuss the news affecting the Latino community is Maria Elena Salinas, national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish language television network. Well, what a week it has been, Maria Elena.
I know. I still have whiplash from it.
All right. So from your perspective where you sit, you're the anchor of a national news program that not only reaches, you know, into millions of homes in the United States, but across Latin America. Your takeaway on what you think is going to happen in terms of Latinos and this meltdown?
Well, you know, Latinos are very much affected by this economy, Maria, and we try to explain to them every day in the simplest of terms how their everyday lives, you know, from gas prices to food prices to the mortgage crisis. And, you know, when you think about it, it affects everyone, really, but it particularly affects immigrant workers, you know, who are already at the bottom of the pay scale. So as if it wasn't bad enough that all these immigration rates have, you know, led so many companies in the country to stop hiring these unskilled workers and either firing them or not hiring them, I should say. You know, now the economy is in shambles. There's no work. Like I said before, the crisis in the housing industry is affecting many of those who also work in construction. We hear stories all the time of immigrants just returning to their countries because it's just too hard to survive these hard times. It's not only affecting the way that they work, but also their everyday lives because they can't afford to live.
What kinds of stories are you doing on Univision about this? Like when you're reporting about the economic crisis and what it means for this country and around the world, what are the stories that Univision would air, for example?
I think we do a little bit of both. It's almost like Economy 101, like you're seeing in a lot of these channels. We're trying to explain to people what is going on and how it's going to affect them because, you know, so many times when you throw all these zeros at them and these billions and trillions and try to figure out how to translate it, all these zeros from English to Spanish, you know, something gets lost in the translation. And what people really need to know is, how is my life going to be affected? How is my personal economy going to be affected? What is it that I need to look out for? What should I do with the little bit of money that I do have? How do I protect it? You know, we are figuring that a lot of immigrants probably do not have accounts in Wall Street. Sometimes they tend to think that because they're not big-time investors, that a crisis like this is not going to affect them directly when it is going to affect them.
All right, Maria Elena, let's switch gears here and move to a story out of California. This is an update on this immigration march. Plans have been released to discipline 11 officers and terminate 4 because of their use of excessive force. What's your take on all of this, Maria Elena?
The chief of police, William Bratton, said this incident was called a phenomenal black eye, and that's what happened to the Los Angeles Police Department, who has been struggling for years to try to clean up its act and clean up its image. Well, it's kind of funny, Maria, because it's too little too late. I mean, this was an event that happened a year and a half ago. I mean, how much investigation do they need to do? This was caught on tape. The press was there to document what was happening, and the press was also affected because we saw that a lot of reporters and cameramen were also beat up and abused by the police officers. And, you know, when you think about it, all they get is a suspension, which is equivalent to a slap in the wrist. 4 of them are losing their jobs. Well, you know, they'll find other jobs as security guards, I imagine. So, you know, some of these people who were victims of this abuse are sort of now waiting to see if maybe the justice system will come through. So, you know, what does it really mean? I think it's the city trying to clean up their act. It's saying, you know, we're not going to tolerate this because there have been so many other incidences of abuse and of police brutality.
Maria Elena, and on a sad note here, a new survey out of Pew is documenting that Latinos in the United States are, quote unquote, increasingly pessimistic about their situation in the United States. What do you read into this?
It's a very sad situation, but it really all boils down to the very negative tone of the immigration debate. Not only immigrants are being affected by the negative tone, a couple of examples of what this survey is saying. It says that nearly 10% of Latinos say that they have been stopped by police or other authorities and asked about their immigration status, and that includes 8% of Latinos who were born in the United States. So it's definitely racial profiling. And about 15% of them say it's been hard for them to keep a job, and 10% said that the same thing about finding a job or keeping housing. So this very negative anti-immigrant sentiment that has hit the country is really affecting the psyche of Latinos and making them feel like they're not wanted. They're not wanted in their own country.
Pretty distressing news, Maria. Definitely sad. Thanks for joining us again this week, Marielena.
Thank you, Maria. Nice to talk to you, like always.
Marielena Salinas is the national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish language television network. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Everyone is talking about it, and everyone is thinking about it. The economy. We're all scared, and yet we don't know what exactly we're afraid of. Now, usually, anything that has to do with economics means I pick up the phone and I call my brother, the professor and economist. This time, this crisis is so big that we at Latino USA made the decision to bring my brother on as a guest on the show. His name is Raul Hinojosa Ojeda. He's the executive director of the North American Integration and Development Center at UCLA. All right, well, Professor Raul Hinojosa, welcome to Latino USA.
It's great to be here, my sister.
So let's just start from how did we get into this mess? And in particular, Raul, when you talk about this, imagine that you're talking about Latinos and what particular role Latinos and immigrants play in this whole situation.
It turns out that Latinos have a very, very important role, both in terms of how we got into this mess and also how the workout is going to take place. The data is quite staggering. 40% of the mortgages in the troubled subprime market that we're talking about were sold to Latinos. And by the way, African Americans, half of the homes that they bought and about half of the homes that Latinos bought in the last few years were in these particular types of very high-cost mortgages.
So let me just stop you there, because were these Latinos and African Americans who were given these mortgages, sold these essentially very risky mortgages, were they eligible for other mortgages, regular mortgages, or were they or were subprime mortgages pushed upon them?
The reality of it is there has been a long history of redlining in the banking industry and in the mortgage industry. And many of these customers were not seen as somebody to be taken seriously by the banking institutions for many years. Again, the last 10 years were seen as a period where they needed to find new markets to expand the mortgage market, and they went after Latinos who had not traditionally, and many other African Americans, and even poor whites a lot, by the way, who had not traditionally gotten mortgages. So, you know, I think there's a really important lesson to be learned here, and it's one that is both local in the United States as well as global. Most people around the world that are going to be the new customers for financial instruments are poor. They are not your prime customers. They are your subprime customers, and you need to create a set of products in there that are respectful for them and that are good, that they can absolutely afford. So we really need a new ethic about how to treat the subprime customers with respect, give them good mortgages, give them good bank accounts that are really geared toward their needs. Turns out that's good for them and that's good for the entire system. And that's the only way we're going to eventually deal with these problems, both within the United States and around the world, in a way that does bottom-up economics that we all gain from.
We once had somebody on this show who said that this subprime mortgage crisis was essentially the greatest transfer of wealth out of the African-American community ever in history. So are we talking about the same thing in terms of Latinos in this country?
Well, potentially. I mean, especially if what happens is that many of these people who were sold subprime loans are the ones who are not going to be taken care of, and they're the ones that are going to have to go into bankruptcies and foreclosures. Absolutely, this will be a disaster. The workout now, if you think about it, is really trying to take care of who first? The people that were putting these risky loans together in these fancy derivative products. Meanwhile, the people who got stuck holding the bag in the first place, a lot of these Latinos and African Americans, etc., are now at the top of the list in terms of losing their homes and getting their credits destroyed.
Okay, Raul, well, it was funner talking to you about this via satellite than over breakfast at Mom and Dad's house, but thanks for joining us.
Well, let's do huevos y chorizo soon anyway.
Professor Raul Hinojosa Ojeda is the executive director of the North American Integration and Development Center at UCLA, and he's my brother. So just what would a collapsed economy mean for the average U.S. worker? Working longer hours with lower wages? That might not be so hard to imagine if you just look south of the border. Klaus Andreasen has this update from Tijuana, 15 years post-NAFTA.
We are driving around the Maquiladora zone at the industrial park in Otay, Tijuana. Very highly secure. They look more like prisons.
Tijuana-born architect Marcela Guadiana Cerda shows me how parts of her hometown have changed over the past decades.
There are no green spaces or air between them.
We pass rows of maquiladoras on each side of the poorly paved street. They resemble big white sugar cubes with high security fences at the entrances and only few and small windows covered with solid bars. There are about 700 maquiladoras in Tijuana, employing close to 150,000 people, a majority of them women. Though they provide work opportunities, it is a depressing sight, Marcela says.
For me, it's a very sad view. How you see it out here, imagine the condition inside.
Low wages, long hours, and dangerous working conditions are commonplace at the maquiladoras. But now maquila workers are demanding more rights. Not far from the Otay Industrial Park is CITAC, the Information Center for Working Men and Women. Housed in what used to be a small warehouse, this non-governmental organization performs important legal services for workers of the maquilas. Jorge Luis Guerra tells me about his job at a maquila that made furniture. He's a trained technician and was paid a little more than the average salary at the plant, $9 a day. The work was hard and dangerous, he says, and we had little or no protection. 2 years ago, the factory started having financial difficulties, so the nearly 1,000 workers were locked out, and the company stopped paying them.
Ahorita nos encontramos en un proceso de una demanda penal.
We filed a lawsuit, and with CITAC's help, we've been able to get about 25% of what we're supposed to get in lost income and benefits. But we want the rest of what we're owed.
Entonces, gracias a eso, llegamos a un convenio. Nos dieron el 25% de lo que nos correspondía.
Guadalupe Jimenez has had similar experiences. She tells me how she was verbally harassed by her supervisors at a maquila that made eyeglasses, and how she was working with dangerous chemicals like strong solvents. Many of the workers were injured, she says, and one of them died.
En lo que yo supe, pues, del tiempo que yo tenía trabajando, la primera que había fallecido, pues, fue esa compañera.
From what I know, Marina was the first to die. I also personally know three women who had spontaneous abortions and lost their babies as they were working at the factory.
Tres compañeras abortaron, unas ahí mismo.
These stories of wrongful termination, harassment, and dangerous working conditions are typical of what happens in the maquiladoras in Tijuana, says CITAC activist Enrique Dávalos.
In terms of the factories who, when they are in economic crisis, they just run away and try to escape, avoiding any obligation that they have with the Mexican workers. That essentially is the norm. It's exactly what they are prepared to do.
CETA claims to have countless records of labor rights violations. The Mexican government counters that there are strong labor laws on the books. But CETAC founder Jaime Cota says that the government wants to continue attracting foreign investments. So the Maquiladora district is, at least unofficially, a free zone where these laws aren't respected.
La industria maquiladora es como si fuera una zona libre de la Ley Federal del Trabajo. O sea, la Ley Federal del Trabajo no se aplica dentro de la industria maquiladora.
Although companies can find cheap and skilled workers in Mexico, the labor force may still be cheaper somewhere else, for instance in China. We have seen some maquiladoras close and move to other countries, says Enrique Dávalos, but there are also those that move in the other direction.
China's exportation to the U.S. has to pay a tax. When they, instead of paying this tax, they come to Mexico, they say, we are Mexicans, no? So we cross the border without paying the tax, no?
After 15 years of NAFTA, the free trade agreement has been slated as an economic triumph, since trade with the U.S. has tripled. But the success has come at a very high social cost to the workers, says James Cooper, professor of law at the California Western School of Law in San Diego, just across the border. And he points to the rise in migrants trying to cross to the United States.
NAFTA was supposed to create jobs in Mexico and stop migration. And the U.S. was going to be the knowledge economy, and Mexico would be the workshop. That hasn't worked.
Cooper says workers are protected by good laws, but still choose to migrate.
Oftentimes, in these countries, the laws are great. The laws are better than they are in Canada and the United States. The trouble with all of this, just as it is with all sorts of other international agreements, is enforcement.
Mexican workers like Jorge Luis Guerra may not find migrating to the United States as it once was. With his experience and technical skills, he believes a job on the U.S. side would pay about $600 a week, almost seven times as much as he's making in the Maquila right now. Although it sounds very tempting, he's not sure it's worth the risk of trying to make it across the border.
Pues, o sea que le hay ocasiones que sí le he pensado, pero el problema es que está muy complicado porque
I have thought about crossing, but it's much harder now. I would have to walk for at least a week through the desert, and I'm not sure I'm prepared to do that.
Estamos hablando de un promedio de una semana para darle la vuelta a todo por donde no haya tanta vigilancia.
In spite of the bad wages and poor working conditions, the maquiladora industry is likely to remain in the border region. And for people with only a basic school education, there are few alternatives of finding a job, says Marcela Guadiana Cerda, as we're about to leave Otay Industrial Park.
Maquila is like un mal necesario, no? Like a necessary evil. Because what would we do with all of that people that really depend on it?
For Latino USA, I'm Klaus Andreasen in Tijuana, Mexico.
In a minute, desde la frontera, stories from the border. Coming up on Latino USA, no se vayan. We'll be right back. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. August Evening is an award-winning independent film opening nationwide this month. It's a bittersweet portrayal of an immigrant family in South Texas, written and directed by Chris Esca. The dialogue of the film is entirely in Spanish, even though Esca only speaks English. He says he was inspired from his experiences growing up in the poor border region of South Texas. From KSTX in San Antonio, Nathan Cohn has our story.
August Evening is about an aging, undocumented farm worker and his widowed daughter-in-law struggling to move on in life after personal loss. For inspiration, Chris Esca looked to his own backyard and around the world.
This story is definitely influenced by events in my own family's history, but also from friends of mine growing up in Gonzales, Texas, which is a majority Latino farming community. So I knew a lot of families similar to this one when I was a child. But also I rely on stories of friends and their families from places like Japan or India. And the idea is that I'm trying to talk about universal human emotions so that people in Germany can watch this Latino family and say that they see their family reflected in that story.
And for this movie about a first and second generation immigrant family to be authentic, Esca chose to shoot the movie in Spanish, even though he doesn't speak the language. Esca says that doesn't matter.
I think that what film does best is expressing emotion through things like music and editing and montage, the subtle glance of an actor or just body language. And so that way I don't have to get caught up in the syntax and I can put my efforts towards what's important about a film.
María es como un sueño. No quiero que mis memorias de ella se me vayan yendo como las de Manuel. Hoy fue la primera vez que he visitado su tumba desde que conocí a Luis. Nunca pensé que yo cambiaría así.
Así nos hacemos todos. Pero al final de cuentas, la vida sigue adelante.
There's another reason I also wanted to do it in Spanish. It's because I wanted to tell a story about a slightly more traditional family structure. And so I wanted to set it in the first and second generation immigrant world because I feel like any family, no matter the background, any family that's been in this country for more than a couple of generations, we tend to spread out. You know, my sister lives in New York. I was living in LA. We'd see our parents maybe once a year if we were lucky. And so when I want to talk about the intergenerational duty, it made more sense to come home and set it in the immigrant community that's right in the community that I grew up with.
Esca cast August Evening with a combination of professional actors and untrained talent. For the lead role of Jaime, Esca chose Pedro Castañeda after meeting him at a San Antonio nonprofit. Castañeda was there to install wireless networks.
Chris approached me and asked me if I could read some lines. I told him that I wasn't there for any auditions. And he goes, "No, I know, but I like your boots and I like the way you look." And I kind of saw it as strange, so I said no. And he asked me to read the script. I said, okay, I'll read the script. I read the script. I liked it. Kind of related to my family and my parents. And I said, well, if you're willing to take a chance, I'll go ahead and try it.
Castañeda says he drew from personal experience in crafting his portrayal of Jaime, an undocumented farm worker struggling to get by and still offer a better life for his children.
I tried to put myself in my father's shoes. You know, how he would have to get up early, go to work, and how I could see, you know, how tired he was. But he kept going, and I tried to do that. I tried to just be my father, basically. We, as children, really didn't understand the problems. But, you know, we had cousins who were better off, and they had toys, and we didn't. They got to go on vacations, and we didn't. So, you know, we did feel the differences, but it didn't affect us that much.
At its heart, August Evening is one family's story. It's about letting go of the past, finding new love after loss, and looking with a hopeful eye to the future. But if the movie inspires audiences in other ways, that's okay with director Chris Esca.
I feel like a lot of times people make a film about an issue that's dear to their heart. And sometimes it's very straightforward or sometimes overtly political. But I wanted to take a different approach. And so I just wanted to really humanize this family and show that everything they're going through emotionally is exactly the same as what every other family goes through. If people watch the film and because they connect with this Latino family and that changes the way they feel about the way we treat immigrants in this country, then that would certainly make me very happy.
August Evening won the John Cassavetes Award at the Spirit Awards earlier this year. Pedro Castañeda, the film's star, was also nominated for Best Actor at the Spirit Awards. August Evening recently opened in New York and San Antonio and later moved to Los Angeles, Austin, Portland, and other cities in the fall. Check their website at augustevening.com for more release dates and information. For Latino USA, I'm Nathan Cohn.
In this election, one after another, the presidential candidates call for change. We in the Rio Grande Valley are ready for change.
For Father Michael Seifert, social change requires hard work.
We look forward to the 2008 elections, for many here have recently discovered the power of the vote. We believe, as Dr. Martin Luther King said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Despite the hardness of life here, we love the valley. There's a quality of life here that is missing in Houston or Dallas. There's an intangible spirit that defies the measures of the social sciences. Some call it solidarity, others a love for the extended family or community. The valley is one place in America where neighbors still unashamedly go door to door to ask for donations for a funeral, where no one sleeps on the streets, where no one goes without a meal, however simple that offering might be. We consider ourselves sisters and brothers, and today's harsh anti-immigrant voices have deepened that sense of community. We especially care about our children. When the president vetoed the expansion of children's health coverage, the anger here was palpable. My own neighborhood organization, Proyecto Digna, has joined with other groups nationwide in the Equal Voice for America's Families campaign. Families are sharing their dreams for their children, that they will grow up in safe housing with quality health care and education. Together, we are creating a national platform of family issues. In the Rio Grande Valley, we are people of faith, hope, and long-suffering love. We understand the hard work that social change requires, and we're not afraid of that. After all, we are the legacy of Cesar Chavez and of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Father Michael Seifert is president of Proyecto Digna, based in Brownsville, Texas. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. We had help this week from Jorge Olivares and Monica Lopez. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And by Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, committed to expanding human welfare through economic growth, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.